Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This week on the U of I campus, there is a symposium going on that's being sponsored by the African American Studies and Research Program, looking at the role of black women in civil rights and in 20th century black history. Yesterday morning on the program, we had as our guest Darlene Clark-Hind. She's director of the Center for African American History at Northwestern. She was here on the program to talk a bit about black women and their role in civil rights and in American history. This morning, we're pleased to have another guest who is here visiting the campus in connection with this symposium. Her name is Juliana Richardson, and we'll be talking about an effort that she started in Chicago called the History Makers, which is a very ambitious oral history project aimed at collecting the stories of black Americans, sometimes people who are well known, other times people who are not, and putting that together in a very large archive in a way that scholars and ideally just about anyone can use. We will talk about why it is that she started this and what it is that she's hoping to achieve and perhaps some of the challenges behind this. Also, I do want to mention for people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana that our guest, Juliana Richardson, will be giving a talk about the project at noon today in room 151 of Everett Lab. That's on Green Street in Urbana, 1406 West Green. So I'm sure anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Otherwise, here on the program, questions are welcome, 333-9455. And the toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us is 800-222-9455. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. She's a graduate of Brandeis University, where she studied theater arts and American studies, and also Harvard Law School, where she worked as a corporate lawyer before serving in the early 80s as the cable administrator for the City of Chicago Office of Cable Communications. There she established the Chicago Cable Commission. She went on to found Shop Chicago, a regionally based home shopping channel. And then for 8 years, she ran a production company, that SCTN Teleproductions, that managed three local cable channels for the nation's largest cable operator. They also served as production arm for C-SPAN, People's Energy, ESPN, the Economic Club of Chicago, AT&T Broadband, and Prime Cable. And she's here with us this morning. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
To start, I'd like to have you tell the story of why it is that where it is you got this this idea and you embarked on this project. I know that it was at a point where you had done a lot of different things and perhaps you were simply looking for something new and different to do back in, I guess it was 1999. How is it that this idea occurred to you?
Well, I've had a very eclectic background, as you recounted there for the audience. I was really at a point where I think you get at a point in your life where you want to make a difference or leave a legacy. And a lot of this project is a very personal passion that I'm hoping that the larger community will embrace and make happen. It's something that is so vitally needed. I often say that the project had several beginnings. One, I could say that as a small elementary school student in my town of Newark, Ohio, where when asked about my ethnic background, I was the only black student in the class, and everyone was so proudly talking about they were of German ancestry or French ancestry. And in that classroom, the only thing that we studied about were two things related to black people. One was George Washington Carver, and the other was slavery. And it was really hard for me as a young student to believe that white people were talking about George Washington Carver, but that he had done all these things with peanuts when all we had been were slaves. So it seemed, sort of a quantum leap. I sort of spin forward to being a sophomore at Brandeis University, and I often say I found the rich treasure trove of the Schomburg Library, and found that as I was doing research on the Harlem Renaissance and later Langston Hughes, that black people had done a lot of things. They had written, I remember sitting in the Schomburg Library and listening to I'm Just Wild About Harry and, you know, finding it had been written by a black songwriting team. And that really, a whole world opened up to into itself. And I actually did oral histories, interviewed people like Butterfly McQueen and an actor named Lee Whipper, all part of the Harlem Renaissance movement. And then, and those stories really, they stayed with me. They were living in impoverished conditions up in Harlem. My background's in theater, so, you know, in many ways, this is, you know, I say all my roads, all my paths have led to, you know, to where I am right now. But in many ways, this project is about storytelling. I'd always been, had gravitated to the arts because I found it was a non-offensive way of exposing people to different cultures. And basically, back in 1999, I was at a crossroads. The channels I've been managing were going to be taken back through the city. I didn't want to go back to practicing corporate law. I was concerned about images of black people. And, you know, we had passed the era of the Cosby show, where people were even questioning whether black people were really like that, you know, in the Cosby show. And so I wanted to, you know, create this archive and of first-person stories, and that's really, you know, what originated it. I should say one other thing is that our attempt with the History Makers is sort of a monumental attempt because there's only been one time in the history of the United States that there's been a massive attempt to record the African-American experience by the First Voice, and that was with the slave narratives. And people who know, some people know, other people don't know about the slave narratives, but they were done during the WPA project. Mm-hmm. And there were, between the years of 1936 and 1938, 2,300 former slaves interviewed as part of that project. Some on audio cassette, not a lot, but still a massive attempt there. And I did not know at the time that I started the History Makers about the Spielberg Shoah Foundation project. That's the largest video oral history project we will see any time in the foreseeable future. Steven Spielberg, after he did Schindler's List, did 52,000 interviews in a five-year period. Often people ask me how I got to 5,000. It's a combination between the slave narratives and the Shoah Foundation. It's 10% of the Shoah Foundation and almost double, a little more than double the slave narrative.
So I just want to make sure people understand that's your goal. What you're hoping to do is have in this archive,
right,
have 5,000.
That's right. We are only at 1,400, so we're about 20% of our goal. It's taken us 6 years to get there. I've developed a prototype a lot. This is a very expensive undertaking, mainly because it involves video, you know, and crews traveling around the country. Mm-hmm. But I feel we have the beginning of an infrastructure. We've raised about $7 million, but it's a $25 million project with no celebrity name attached to it either.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful project, first of all, and also extraordinarily ambitious thing to take on.
Yes.
I know, having read some stories where you've talked about the fact that back in 1999, when you got this idea and you started telling people that you wanted to do this, the reaction was that they thought that you were crazy.
They thought I was crazy. They thought I had literally lost my mind. And it took me some time, really, to understand that archives outside the scholarly community sound old and dusty and not of much use. And people just, they didn't understand what it was. And I think even sometimes today that people don't understand, you know, what it is. But really, if you look at it in terms of a living, breathing repository of first-person stories, we do even with oral histories, you know, often in the African-American community, people say we're of oral tradition. that's totally different than the discipline of oral histories. And I often think, like, what would have happened if Ellen Nevins, who's the founder of oral history in this country, if he had, you know, been involved in the Slave Narrative Project? That project ended about 6 years, 6 to 8 years before Ellen Nevins started out of Columbia University. And the oral history is really, you know, a relatively, you know, new discipline. The goal, he was really trying to document with the entry of the telephone. There weren't people writing their papers. And so really, oral history was the province really of the wealthy, you know, Winston Churchill, presidential papers. It was only in the 1970s that you saw the popularization and the funding to some extent of you know, great migration stories, women's stories, ethnic stories. But still, you know, when I got started, I mean, just to say, one, to have an ambitious goal like this, and, you know, and to talk about the need, people didn't really quite understand the need. And I remember one weekend, three friends of mine getting me together, you know, because they were like, you know, what are you doing? And they said I had to answer two questions. One, did an archive like the one that was envisioned, did it exist already? Because they weren't sure that I had really done my homework and, you know, probably it existed in some form. The second thing is that they said, if it didn't exist and one was created, would anyone be interested? And they theorized no. So in many ways, really, I feel that we have just ended a proof of concept phase with a accumulation of 1,400. I, in those early years, got you know, some interns as I was sort of closing off my work with the cable channels. And I got some interns together, and I literally had a young woman. She recently left me to go back to school, but her name was Crystal Foster. And I would go home and I would think, I'm going to write to all the TV stations tomorrow. And then I would send out letters. And then I would say, I'm going to write to, you know, all the radio stations. And lo and behold, WBBM AM picked up a year-long radio series. I'd never produced, you know, anything, but I took a few of the interviews I'd done previously with another project. And things start, and then I was using the internet to do a lot of research, but here we are, and we're no longer a concept, but we still have a lot of work to do to reach our goal.
Let me just introduce again the guest, if you might have tuned in the last few minutes. We're talking with Juliana Richardson. She's the founder and executive director of the History Makers Initiative. It's based in Chicago, and as she explained, this was a project. She came up with the idea for this in 1999, and then I believe in 2000 actually started doing the interviews. The goal is to conduct 5,000 interviews of African Americans, and some of these will be people who are well known, but many of them are people who are not, getting them the opportunity to talk about their lives, and then to put this in a kind of an archive so that scholars and eventually anybody can use it. And she's been going now for a while. As we said, the goal, she said she hopes 5,000 to be the total there. We've done about 1,400 so far. And she's here visiting the campus to talk about the project, and we'll be giving a noontime talk today. So if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to meet her or hear more from her, you can do that. And otherwise, here on the program, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call if you have questions. Can you talk just a little bit about who are some of the people of who are some of these 1,400 people that you've already done interviews with?
Yes, well, we have done. First of all, I should say we identified 15 different categories: law, business, science, education. We even have a style category for people in the fashion and beauty industry. A lot of times, I also want to say with oral history projects, people often do subject matter oral histories. What we do are life oral histories. Mm-hmm. Our average length is 3 hours in length, or our longest is 17 hours. Our oldest history maker is 105. Our youngest is 36. We have done probably less in sports and entertainment. Science, we haven't done a lot. And, you know, done a lot more in education and politics, and we've been moving more into, you know, the business categories. Some of the interviews, I just, I should talk about some recent interviews. I was just in Washington, D.C. I don't do a lot of interviews now. I love doing oral history interviews, I have to say. You're very well researched today, too, so I can give you congratulations, because you have to go into this these interviews being well researched. But anyway, I just finished an interview with a gentleman named William Coleman. It took me literally the length of the project to get him to sit for an interview. He didn't like the term African-American because he came along at a time that people either were called colored or black or Negro. He's 86 years old. He was the first, he's a lawyer. He went to Harvard Law School, which, you know, I'm an alumnus of. He had been served as Secretary of Transportation under Ford. He had been the first black clerk at the U.S. Supreme Court under Justice Frankfurter. He has been very active as a corporate lawyer, which, you know, is sort of legendary in of itself. I also recently interviewed a woman named Shirley Jackson, who's president of Rensselaer Polytechnic, who is a very bright woman, was served under President Clinton under the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, was the first black to graduate from, well, no, first female, black or white, to receive a PhD from MIT. And we do, we've done, I should talk about one interview that I did in the early days of the project. As I was trying to sort of balance off well-known with unsung people, and I had attempted to, at the beginning of the year, we were really identifying people who were Tuskegee Airmen or Pullman Porters. And I was going to interview a man named Colonel Thompson. And I was thinking, why am I going to interview Colonel Thompson? You know, I should be interviewing someone better known. And he had prepared for 4 days for our project. When I arrived, he had boxes and boxes of photos. He had been the chief documentarian for the Tuskegee Airmen, and parts of his collection are in the Air and Space Museum. And so he sat me down and asked if I knew about the Golden 13. And I said, no, Colonel Thompson, I don't know about the Golden 13. And he said, well, they are the Navy's version of the Tuskegee Airmen. And four still living in this country, and one lives upstairs, and he'd like to talk to you also. Now, that gentleman he had us talk to was not so big. His experience as part of the Navy's Golden 13 wasn't a very, you know, positive experience, and he really didn't have a lot to say. I then had the occasion 2 years ago then to be seated next to Colin Powell. And I was telling him this story as I was trying to get him to sit for an interview, which he finally did this year. But that evening he was saying squarely no, you know, he had been well documented. But I was telling him the story about the Golden 13. It must have impressed him, though, because he then told me about the Montford Point Marines, who were the Marines' version of the Tuskegee Airmen, but virtually no one knows, you know, about these stories. And there are really thousands of stories of experiences. I mean, think about, a lot of people think about our project, they think of it as a civil rights project. There's one problem, you know, with that. It's as if both in the black community and in the larger community, that there's a very marginalized view of our contributions and our history. I consider it our history, one of the last frontiers of American history. There are other lost histories, you know, of people who've come, you know, here. So we're really trying to expose this history through these, you know, first-person stories.
Yeah. Are there, I don't want to overemphasize the significance of celebrities, people who are well known. And I guess I would count someone like Colin Powell as being in that category because he is certainly very well known. But having said that, do you have a kind of a list of people that you would really like to be able to interview and include that perhaps so far either you haven't been able to talk to or it's been like Colin Powell. It's that they seem reluctant or they're maybe they're just very busy or you just haven't been able to do it. But really, if you would like to, there are some people that you would say, oh, yes, absolutely. If that person would do it, I would be there.
Yes, there are several people there are lots of people that fit in that category. I mean, first of all, the project is hugely envisioned. We are conscious of that sort of each and every day. And we have not done a lot of people in the field of jazz. We've done really no one in the field of gospel. We have this year I got Reverend Jackson to sit. I have been, chasing him around, and I finally got him, to sit. Minister Louis Farrakhan is ill, and I'm, concerned about us, being able to sit with him. We have, we've lost people. Like, I lost Dr. Leon Sullivan, who had been part of the Sullivan Plan, and, very sort of rich history there. And he had said that he was, he would sit, and I was trying to wait till I got other people, since he was in Phoenix, to go. We are headed, though, next week over to Norway to interview Anne Brown. She's 94 years old. She was the first Bess in Porgy and Bess on Broadway. She has been in Norway living since the 1940s. She married an Olympic skater there and has, had taken up residency there. And it was only through a woman named Effie Lee Morris, who is a children's librarian in San Francisco, that we even found out. Effie Lee Morris visited my office, and somehow I was mentioning Anne Brown, and she says, "You want Anne Brown? I can get you in touch with Anne Brown." So in many ways, this is almost like being, a new frontier, looking for stories. And I should also emphasize this, that one of the things that is counterintuitive about our project is that we are not so much interested in the person, but the history that resides inside of them. And you don't know where history resides. I mean, someone may be well known, but they don't really know much about their background. And then there are other people that are not well known, and they're like real rich treasure troves of history. Mm-hmm. I would say our oldest memory in our collection goes back to the revolutionary days of Canada. We're moving forward as we move forward, even into the, sort of hip hop generation, but we've not done a lot there.
Now, I've read several stories in which you've been quoted about this effort over time, and understandingly, because it's such an ambitious project, every story there's a different goal, an end point where you're saying, "Well, I hope we're going to be done by this point, or maybe That's by right. this point." I think the last story I saw was one from the beginning of last year, where you said that maybe you thought you could be finished by 2009. What do you think now?
No, this is horrible. I think now that, no, it won't. It'll be 2010, 2011. It all has to do with funding, because earlier this year I had to let my interview team, I had a full-time staff, I had to let them go. And so this year we've done fewer interviews than back in 2001. It really has to do with funding. We have the infrastructure, the beginning of an infrastructure there. But, it's funding, it's equipment. There, you have to have processes in place. The people who are representing you, very important. I mean, we're dealing with a community that is not a very trustful community, and it's a community I also believe doesn't feel it has a history, and if it has a history, it's not necessarily a positive one. Now, some people would take exceptions to that statement, but I'm convinced about, you know, that.
We are at our midpoint here, and I have a caller. We'll get to you in just a moment. I want to take enough time to introduce again our guest, Juliana Richardson. She's the founder and executive director of the History Makers Initiative. It's based in Chicago, and as she has explained, it's been going on now for a number of years, and her goal is to put together an archive of interviews on video of 5,000 individuals, 5,000 African-Americans from various walks of life in various taking various career paths, talking about their experience. And the idea is to capture some of this history that might otherwise be lost, which is really not only a part of the African-American experience, but part of the American experience, and have it there in a way that scholars can use it, but anyone who is interested can use it. She is here visiting the campus. She's taking part in a symposium titled Black Women and Activism, sponsored by the African American Studies and Research Program here at the U of I. And she'll be giving a talk about her project at noon today in 151 of Everett Lab on West Green in Urbana. And I'm sure anybody who's interested can stop by and can hear from her. Questions are welcome here as well. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have somebody here in Champaign County to talk with on our line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask about sort of a category of people that, you know, wonder whether anybody is of original first person is available or whether some of their progeny are available. And this is the idea of the mass migration to the north, but most of that is thought of in terms of the mass migration to the cities. But I have some inkling that some number of African Americans came north and bought land in rural areas. Nate Banks, who you might have met at the Afro-American Cultural Studies Unit, I think he told me that his family was rural when they came up here. And they eventually moved into Champaign. And this in the context of this book about sundown towns, there were hundreds of sundown towns in Illinois. And I just was thinking if there was any way of getting first or maybe second generation reminiscences of African Americans who lived in the countryside in the north here and had to experience that kind of thing of going into town and shopping in a town that where they knew that, like in Villa Grove, just south of here, a whistle would go off when it was time for them to get, as it were. So I don't know if you think in terms of sort of categories of people like that, but it seems like that would be a good way to go as far as, you know, particularly when you're thinking of not the famous people, but the common folk. And I think I'll hang up and listen on the air.
Okay, sure. Thanks for the call.
Okay, well, let me just say in response to the caller's question that we are not doing subject matter oral histories. I can tell you, though, that within our archives we have stories like that that exist probably in lots of different parts, you know, of the United States. I also want to say that the Schomburg Library produced a very important project called Migration, where they trace really over the period of time of African-American presence here in the country, about 13 different migrations. But we have those. We just don't approach it from a subject matter way typically, though I would say that we are interested. We define our history makers as one of two ways: someone who has made accomplishments that may be nationally known or not, but other people who have a unique vantage point of different movements, organizations, events, or time that are relevant to the African-American experience.
All right, let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Champaign, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just want to suggest, David, that you give your guest a tape, or at least see maybe that she can hear it, just out of interest. I mean, the last caller answers part of my question, but the university high school students who did the oral histories with the African-American community here in Champaign-Urbana is very, very interesting. It probably wouldn't fit into your archives, but it is so interesting. And I don't know who collects that kind of thing, but they did an excellent job. I just thought she might be interested in at least hearing it.
We would be very interested, and we are interested in other collections. We have the goal is to create a digital archive that is searchable by image and text, and we've been the beneficiaries of this wonderful technology that's been developed out of Carnegie Mellon that will allow, with just typing in certain keywords, able to open up our archive. And this is sort of, we're on the leading edge of where technology is going in this country. But we're very interested in existing collections that exist out there because we believe we have the technology. We primarily, we're a video collection, but we are also interested in some audio cassette collections. In fact, out of Fisk University, there had been an oral history project, and they had people, well-known people like James Weldon Johnson and, I can't remember who else they had in their collection. And we've been trying to negotiate with them for some time the donation of that into, our archives. We would, in exchange, give them transcripts and make the collection, index the collection so it would be searchable. So to the caller's point, we are very interested in knowing about existing oral history collections. Frankly, there has not been any indexing of existing collections that would be relevant for our, for us, that would fit within our sort of collecting model. There has been no indexing. A lot of these things exist, within university archives, or, there may be even documentary film producers that have source tapes. And we are interested in that, but we are trying, a collection, I should say, is only as good a lot of times as its consistency. So we did not want to be sort of a hodgepodge, but in terms of, being able to get things in, we would be very interested in that.
Mm. If there's one thing I've learned about interviewing, not much, but a few things. One is that you need to go into the interview with some idea of what you want to accomplish. And at the same time, you've got to allow the subject to go where he or she will. As an interviewer, you don't want to get in that person's way. If they've got something they want to say, you want to make sure you give them the chance to say that. You talked about the fact that some of the interviews, maybe they average about 3 hours, but you've got one that runs to 17 hours. How do you or do you have some kind of standard approach to the interview so that you get so that there's some structure and you make sure that there are certain things you do get and at the same time allow for the interview subject to say what it is they really want to say?
That's a brilliant question in many ways. I find that not everyone can do a good oral history interview. I found that typically people, because I originally was trying to recruit people who were journalists and also or either documentary film producers because they were, but they had agendas. That's how they came to the interview with sort of preconceived notions. And I also have to say that anyone, like when you're researching someone's background, you're reading, things that have been written or, things they've said. And a lot of times that may not go into their family background. And so you may come to that interview with preconceived notions. So our interviews, first of all, are divided into three parts. There is the part where we're really trying to understand their family background. I would say about 50% of our subjects know a lot, and then 50% know virtually, nothing at all. Mm-hmm. And then we then try to take people through their childhood and their life and career. And, that's sort of the second part. And then we end with what we call philosophical questions. That's a short part. It probably is 10, 15 minutes. But you have to be a good listener. you cannot come to an interview with a list of questions, preconceived notions, and come away with a good interview. I take personally about an hour, really, to try what I call to sort of break the veil with someone, to peel the, you know, the onion. And I have made mandatory of my interview staff that they ask one question, and that is, you know, earlier in the interview, and that is, what sights, smells, and sounds remind you of your childhood? And basically with that question, I'm trying to take people back into another period, an early period of time. I'm trying to reawaken memory. And I'm trying to really trust someone. Like the person that I have found difficult to interview, and I'm not really interested. I've done one, and I'm not really interested in interviewing this category, and that's comedians. They are famous about covering up, you know, themselves, and it's almost impossible to break them. Where, you know, politicians, they go off in political speak, I say, you know, and you have to reel them back in. Also, you have to learn people's speaking patterns. Some people are very quick to respond. Some people are your yes and no, and you've got to get in and make things happen. I mean, I interviewed Congressman Gus Savage, and he almost hit me in tears. I mean, I could not even begin the interview. You know, he was telling me, you know, that I my questions weren't right. You know, I hadn't done my research. I had done my research, you know. I sounded like a white person. I mean, he hit me in tears, and I just finally said, Congressman Savage, why don't you just talk about what you want to talk about? And we got there, you know, but yeah. It's just, the more I do it, the more I understand that it's a skill set. I found very early on in the project, because we were interviewing mainly men, and they were in tears, you know, a lot. And I was just astounded. I was like, oh, I'm like Barbara Walters. You know? But then I found that really, you know, because it is a concentrated period of time, that you, if you can touch a chord with people and you're reawakening memory, and often, you know, I've called them tears of remembrance. I remember interviewing Ramsey Lewis, and he grew up around in Chicago area called Cabrini Green. And we started with Julian Bond actually asking people to bring photos with the interview, and we have them narrate the photos. And so that was one interview where we did the photos first. And there was this beautiful hand-carved piano, a picture of him standing in front of this hand-carved piano with his father, and it looked like almost everyone in the community. And I asked him, you know, I said, oh, I bet when you brought that, your father brought that piano home, you know, that that was really a proud moment. And it was later, we started the interview, and I asked something about his father, and he just started bawling. And so I had you know, he was a little alarmed. I told him, don't be alarmed. You know, everyone cries. But it's that process of sort of reawakening memory and being skillful enough to try to have an agenda, you know, somewhat. You want to get through the interview, not have a runaway train, have somewhat of a chronological, you know, move through. Not someone, you know, we try to take it chronologically. But at the same time, you know, allow it to be unstructured enough and, you know, to be a listener enough that you really find some interesting tidbits that no one knows. Like, there's a man named Ron Rappaport who was a leading sports writer for the Chicago Sun-Times, and he's writing a book on Ernie Banks. Well, he came into our office to look at Ernie Banks' interview. Ernie Banks had told him, and he was just amazed. He said, I would never have asked these questions about Ernie Banks. I didn't even know this whole background of Ernie Banks. Well, I had done the interview. I say I'm not the person who really should be doing sports interview. My whole thing is more arts, culture, and business, politics. But I know how to, you know, elicit someone's background. So he had had a very, Ernie Banks had had a very tragic, all of his brothers and sisters had died tragically.
Maybe just here real quick, I want to, first of all, mention we have about 10 minutes left. in the interview here, in this hour of Focus 580, to again introduce our guest, Juliana Richardson. She's the founder and executive director of the History Makers Initiative. It's based in Chicago. It's a very ambitious project that she embarked on in 2000, hoping to conduct 5,000 interviews with various kinds of African Americans from different backgrounds who do different kinds of things for a living, get their life stories, and record those on video, and then put that into an archive that then can be searchable, can be used by scholars, can be used by anybody who would want to access it. Very, very ambitious project, which she's now saying she thinks maybe, I don't know, 2010, 2011, she'll be completed. 5,000 interviews, and now she and her colleagues and the people who've been working on this project have done 1,400.
Yeah, and let me just say something too, because my deadline has changed, but I do want to give some perspective on this. The largest collection up until the time that we came around was existed in two places. One was the Schomburg Library. They had done 300 interviews in 20 years. And then there was the Birmingham Civil Rights Museum, and they had done 300 interviews in 10 years. And we have, done 1,400 interviews in, 6.5 years. But it is, it is an ambitious undertaking. It's been hard. I would say the thing that has been my biggest bone of contention is that the philanthropic community does not fund us. We have had to raise our money through special events, which people who are attracted to work with us are not thinking that they have to go and work for an event company. So mainly our main funding, I would say 95% of our funding has come from our celebrity interview series, which we did, 3 this year, one with Colin Powell, one with Andrew Young, and most recently Earl Graves. But as a result of the process, we've actually created a franchise within PBS, National PBS. We're known for this celebrity interview series that was really based on Bravo Inside the Actors Studio, because we're all really about storytelling. We actually also have developed an education institute that we've been piloting in Chicago Public Schools for the last 4 years. And we see ourselves really as a combination public history, oral history initiative. We've recently also created a speakers bureau, because we're sitting potentially on the largest African-American speakers bureau, in the country. Mm-hmm. Our website is what we're mainly known for, though. And we're getting now 4 to 6 million hits per month. Google is rated one of the top African-American sites on the Internet. But the site should not be confused with our archive, mainly because our site is a bibliographic tool.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to, forgive me, I don't want to make a big deal.
Oh, no, I didn't mean, no, no, I mean, I understand.
I'm thinking that because of what you're doing is very ambitious and might involve travel and so forth. I'm thinking, if you could do 2 interviews a week, you'd be doing good. And then that's only in a year, that's 100.
Right.
Well, that's it is not an easy thing, not a small thing that you're talking about.
No, not at all. Yeah. And that's why we really need everyone's help. People often ask how we select our subjects, and I say, how do we source? Because so little is known out there. People get older and people sort of forget about them. Really, so little is known in this country about this subject matter. I'm particularly interested in 2 subjects. One is 17th century African American history. We mainly think of African American history in terms of the antebellum South. We mainly think of our slave heritage. I'm also interested in American Indian and and Black history, sort of the combination. Still, a lot is not known about that. If you ask any Black person, they'll mostly say that they have Indian in them and that they're Cherokee. Some people will say Choctaw and Chickasaw. So that sort of fascinates me. I recently heard a wonderful presentation by a scholar out of University of Memphis who had done some important research in this area. I think too, when you look at the holdings of the Library of Congress and the Smithsonian, they really exist in one subject matter only, and that's music, blues, jazz, and gospel, and they have the slave narratives. That's a gross generalization, but there's more truth to it than the generalization. The other thing is that when you look at newspapers, out of the 200 black newspapers in the country, only three of them have archives, and none of those archives are indexed. That's the Chicago Defender, the Philadelphia Tribune, and the Afro-American. You also have Johnson Publishing that, you know, from the 1940s on has a valuable collection, but people are still now just starting to index them. So we really are, you know, we need the scholarly community. You know, we're sort of working hand in hand. You know, we need people to help us identify. But this is the other thing I'm convinced about, is that in this particular instance, the white community and the black community have worked in really unintended complicity, and they've done so really in an unintended way, but they've covered up this wonderfully rich history. It has to do with guilt and shame. Black people did not want to be ashamed of their slave heritage, and white people don't want to feel guilty about it. But when we expose it, and our staff is we have a very diverse staff. It has nothing. We sit often in constant amazement and delight when we hear these stories really unfold in front of us. And it has nothing to do with guilt or shame, but these wonderfully rich human stories of lots of different experiences.
Are you interested in having people make nominations saying to you, I know this person, and I think that this would be a person that should be included in the
program? Yes, and we have a process for that on our website, www.thehistorymakers.com. We have a Nominate the History Makers section. We do look at it. We do contact people, and we, you know, appreciate that. We ask that people be patient with us, though, because people are located all over the country. And we try to group interviews, you know, in that way. And we try each year, in some cases, to expose different, you know, markets. We haven't done well in the northwest part of the United States, or even in the southern part of the United States. But, you know, we really try to, you know, to work.
We have another caller here. I want to make sure I get them in before we end up running out of time. Here is line one. Hello.
Yes. When I tuned in this program, I thought, oh, I would really be very interested in wanting to hear this. But so far, all I've heard is about the process. I haven't heard anything about the content of interviews, which is what I was really interested in.
Yeah. Well, we have talked a little bit about that. But, yeah, you're right. Perhaps we have talked more about the project itself and the ins and outs of it. I'll ask the guest then if you want to talk a little bit more about what's in these interviews.
Take one particular one. Don't talk generalities. I would like to have what one person said.
Sure. Let me take Catherine Dunham. I don't know if the caller knows about Catherine Dunham, but she is really the creator of black dance in this country.
Yes, dancer, I know.
And she just recently, you know, passed away this year. I interviewed her in New York. She had been taken out of St. Louis, where she was sort of living in impoverished conditions, and put up in a senior housing place by Julie Belafonte, who had been her one of the Catherine Dunham dancers. And she talked about she grew up in Peoria. Her mother was actually 20 years older than her father, who was a black tailor, and they lived in Glenview. Her mother was a very fair-skinned person who was half Canadian and half French and, you know, part black. And so Catherine Dunham's had one brother, Albert, who was very, very bright. She even told a story of how Albert actually lost his mind and tried to sort of rip out his eyes. But he had attended the University of Chicago before Catherine Dunham. She also talked about her early years of growing up. After her mother died, her father moved to the western suburbs out near, or, you know, area, wasn't suburbs then, Aurora. And he then worked to try to find another wife to help raise these two kids. She lived for a short time on the south side of Chicago, she and Albert with the aunt, and that was sort of an experience in the black community, but primarily they weren't raised that way. Her father had, it wasn't quite clear if there was some tendency. Catherine reminded him a lot of his wife that had passed away, and there was some attraction or sort of feeling of attraction. So she had a very sort of complicated, sort of cold growing up. As I said, her father, her brother went to the University of Chicago, and then she followed. And people like, can't remember the famous psychiatrist, were her friends. And she had written several books, one of this growing up as a young person. She then was married actually twice. She mainly is known for her second husband, who was Caucasian. And she talked during the interview about how he, I said, well, when did you get married? And I found out she was married the first one, but she didn't really want to talk about that husband. But she said, well, you're married when people consider you man and wife. And she, when you check into the hotel and they consider you man and wife. So here is a woman, her second husband became her manager. And literally, she.
Sorry. Okay. I've got to make you stop because we've got to stop.
Okay, I'm sorry. But for the caller, I have a great story.
Well, if you'd like to find out more about the History Makers, they do have the website, which is www.thehistorymakers.com. And I'm sure that days to come, we'll be hearing more about this project, which was started by our guest, Juliana Richardson. So also, she'll be speaking at noon today as part of a symposium on black women and activism. Her talk is in room 151 of Everett Lab on the U of I campus on West Green Street. So you can stop by and hear more from her. Thank you very much.
Thank you.